talk to strangers. This is episode 11 of Don't Talk to Strangers, a long-form look at the Oakland County child murders from January 1st, 1976 through March 16th, 1977. 9 children in the Detroit area were murdered. If you have not yet listened to previous episodes, please go back and start there. We will be waiting for you. Before we get started, just a reminder that you can find Don't Talk to Strangers on Facebook and on Twitter at DTTSpod. If you have questions, comments, or feedback, you can email me, host@DTTSpodcast.com. This week, we take a bit of a detour, leaving Oakland County entirely, headed north and east to Mount Clemens. The city of Mount Clemens was formed decades before Michigan became a state. The area was settled around 1800 by a man named Christian Clemens. In 1801, he bought a piece of riverfront property and built a home there. In 1818, Territorial Governor Lewis Cass created Macomb County, naming it after General Alexander Macomb, a hero of the War of 1812. Cass named Mount Clemens the county seat and gave Christian Clemens a judicial appointment. It wasn't until the 1870s that the area became known for the healing and restorative properties of the mineral baths. Seeking better health, travelers flocked to the area for treatments. People came from across the country to experience the health benefits of the baths. Even Hollywood types flew in for a visit and a soak. While the origins of the community and its reputation as a site with healing properties hold a certain charm, our story takes place more than 150 years after Mount Clemens was founded. We're looking at two families who raised their children in Mount Clemens: the Lossing family, with mother Hildegard and father Vivian. They had two boys, including James, who they adopted when he was an infant, and James' older brother, Ronald. Also raising their children in Mount Clemens were the Chisholm family. Father David was a Mount Clemens cop. His wife stayed home to raise the kids, Brian, Russell, Bruce, and Corinna. Friday, September 1st, 1978 was a gorgeous late summer day, temperatures in the low 80s and hardly a cloud in the sky. 7-year-old Brian Chisholm thinks it's a great day to play outside with his friends, the usual gang of kids, maybe riding their bikes, perhaps playing ball, maybe checking out a local construction site to see what cool things were there. This is the kids' last weekend of freedom before school resumes on Tuesday after the Labor Day holiday. However, James Lossing is not having a great day. In fact, he hasn't had a great day in a while. James was struggling with emotional issues, and his mother, Hildegard, was overwhelmed trying to help her 23-year-old son, a son that hadn't been quite right since he was hit by a car back in 71. That accident happened when he was just a young teenager, and the accident left him with a fractured skull, an injury that he recovered from, but it also changed him. He was no longer the soft-spoken, gentle child that she'd raised. He was withdrawn, not caring for himself. James was overweight, asthmatic, and no longer interested in maintaining his health or his appearance. James was distinctive looking. He was overweight with small eyes and a double chin. In the years between high school graduation and his death in 1978, he got a tattoo on his right arm, done in blue ink, a sailing ship, and beneath it the legend, "Homeward Bound." But James was not doing well, and his mother, Hildegard, had her own struggles. In 1978, she is 55 years old and dealing with chronic pain from an unsuccessful back surgery. Now, back in 1978, being in your mid-50s was considered much older than being in your mid-50s in 2019. And her husband Vivian, who is 7 years her senior, he's nearly bedridden after suffering several strokes. Vivian required a great deal of assistance with daily activities, and he's not much help to his wife in caring for the home or managing household tasks like cooking or cleaning. While Hildegard is trying to manage her back pain and provide care for her husband, she can see that her son, her little boy that was once so quiet and never any trouble, is in a dangerous spiral. And at first glance, James seems okay. He's got a job as a security guard, and in the summer of 1978, he's 23 years old and living in a tiny apartment above a bar on Harper Road in Clinton Township, just a few miles away from the family home in Mount Clemens. Hildegard spoke to him frequently. She needed help from him at home sometimes because of the medical issues she and her husband were dealing with. But sometime in the summer of 78, there is a shift in James. One that took him from being a strange loner to an aggressive criminal who's targeting young boys. And in the months leading up to the events of September 1st, 1978, Hildegard tried to get help for her son. According to a story in the Macomb Daily, she was concerned that he could be mentally retarded. Now, that's the term that was in the paper, and it was a term that was commonly used at the time. It's not the term we would use today. Clearly, there is something wrong with her son. It wasn't hard to miss the fact that he failed to bathe and groom himself appropriately, and that he wasn't managing his asthma, and that he struggled to hold down a steady job. His apartment, which was basically a studio above a bar, was dirty and disorganized. Hildegard Lossing knew something was wrong, and she reached out repeatedly to the county, to the Children's Aid and Family Society. She would later tell the Macomb Daily in an interview after the murders that, quote, "I told everyone I took him to that he had a problem, and everyone who worked with him agreed, but nobody did anything." She made appointments for James, but since he was an adult, he could refuse to attend them. He skipped appointments and sessions with counselors, doctors, and therapists. After the murder, police reviewed files on James Lossing. In one of those files, there are notes from a meeting between a therapist and Hildegard, where she expressed concern that, quote, "there is no one to guide him." You see, her husband's poor health made him an unlikely candidate to intervene. And James' brother, Ronald, he was in his late 30s with a full-time job and a family of his own to contend with. I'm certain that in hindsight, they both wish they'd done more to intervene. So that's where the Lossing family is on the morning of September 1st, 1978. And what Hildegard doesn't know is that her son, her troubled son, has purchased a handgun, a .22 caliber Derringer. He keeps it in the room he rents above a bar on Harper Road in Clinton Township. He lives in a fleabag place called the Harper Hotel. As I said, September 1st is a lovely summer day, and Lossing decides to go for a drive. It's unknown if he has a plan or if what happens next is impulsive. As he drives north from his rented room into his hometown of Mount Clemens, he spots a group of children playing near a construction site. Again, if you're local, they were playing near the intersection of Floral Avenue and Church Street in Mount Clemens. There are several boys, most of them elementary school age, ranging perhaps from 6 to 11 years old. Lossing parks the car nearby and watches them for a moment. It's approximately 4 o'clock when Lossing exits the vehicle and walks toward the group. He doesn't say anything, but he seizes 7-year-old Brian Chisholm by the hair, dragging him back to his car. Chisholm, the son of Sergeant David Chisholm of the Mount Clemens Police, starts screaming, kicking, and fighting, but he's no match for Lossing, who loads him into the vehicle and drives away. Brian's young friends scatter, trying to find an adult to intervene and help Brian. One of the neighbors who witnessed the kidnapping jumped into his own car to follow Lossing's brown late-model Buick, but he lost sight of the car. What he can offer police is a good description of the vehicle and the driver. It takes less than an hour for an officer to spot the Buick parked at the Harper Hotel, where James is living. And again, if you're local and curious, the hotel
at 38780 Harper Road
is no longer standing. There is an empty lot in its place. It was next to the Trinity Lutheran Church, about a block south of Crocker Boulevard. When police break down the door to Lossing's room, they find a horrific scene. 7-year-old Brian is dead, killed by a single gunshot wound to the head. And not far from his body, police find the remains of 23-year-old James Lossing. He'd shot himself after murdering the child. And there's nothing to be done. In less than 2 hours, Brian Chisholm was kidnapped, assaulted, and murdered, his killer taking his own life, leaving law enforcement with a hideous, inexplicable scene. Sergeant Chisholm was one of the officers who responded to that scene, where fellow officers prevent him from entering the room, attempting to shield him from what became of his little boy. When the child of an officer is taken, every available officer wants in on the case. Mount Clemens Police, Clinton Township Police, the Macomb County Sheriff, everyone was on alert for the driver of the late model Buick who took young Brian. And when the crime scene is discovered, the Sheriff's Department, led by William Hackle, takes over the investigation. And yes, William Hackle is the father of former Macomb County Sheriff and current Macomb County Executive, Mark Hackle. The .22 caliber handgun used in the murder-suicide was purchased legally from a gun dealer, and Lossing took the time to register ownership of the weapon with the Mount Clemens Police Department. The crime scene is assessed and documented, then the bodies are taken to the morgue for examination. This is where they confirm that Brian Chisholm was sexually assaulted prior to being shot. Dr. Werner Spitz, the same physician who autopsied Timothy King in March of 1977, will perform the autopsies in this case. During the autopsy of James Lossing, Dr. Spitz notes a scar in James's brain, a scar he described as approximately 3 inches across, located near the hairline. Spitz theorized that this brain injury could lead to a change in behavior because there is literally damage to Lossing's brain. Spitz could not confirm that the scar was the reason for Lossing's behavioral issues and sudden violence, but brain injuries can lead to behavior changes. The coroner's office ran tests for drugs or alcohol in Lossing's system. The results of these tests were not made public. It's worth mentioning that Lossing and Sergeant Chisholm were known to each other. The Detroit Free Press reported that in 1975, Chisholm served a warrant on Lossing for assault and battery. The charge was later dismissed, and I didn't find anyone who thought that Brian Chisholm was targeted by Lossing. The consensus is that Lossing saw a group of children playing, watched them for a few minutes, then seized the most convenient child to take with him. As the Chisholm case is another child abduction and murder, the Oakland County child killings, which are unsolved yet fresh in the public memory, are mentioned. Honestly, it seems unlikely that someone as disorganized as James Lossing was involved in the Oakland County child murders, but in the days after the murder-suicide, the press released information that James had a distinctive tattoo on his right arm, a sailing ship done in blue ink. This information connected him to the sexual assault of 2 boys, aged 9 and 14, in an assault that occurred in Clinton Township during the first week of August, 1978. Suddenly, James Lossing is a repeat offender. Macomb County knew that Oakland County was still looking for the Oakland County child killer, and they wondered, could James Lossing, lying dead on the floor of his filthy apartment, be the one they're looking for? One of the first calls made after the murder-suicide is to the task force in Oakland County. I'm going to quote the Macomb Daily newspaper here. Detective Sergeant Roger Rivard of the Michigan State Police, who is assigned to the Oakland County cases, said, Lossing did not fit the description of the suspect in those cases, but detectives are attempting to learn if he ever owned or drove a blue Gremlin automobile similar to the one witnesses have connected with several of the abductions in Oakland County. If you think back to the interview I did with Chris King, the brother of Timothy King, in an earlier episode, the task force told him that the blue gremlin would not be the barometer by which suspects are judged. It was so frustrating to read that they were trying to link Lossing to a gremlin in the fall of 78. But I digress. The task force did not believe that Lossing was their guy, and as I mentioned earlier, Lossing was distinctive looking. He was pudgy, with small eyes and a blue tattoo on his right arm. And I'll be honest, I did not intend to cover Lossing beyond a mention in the wrap-up episodes to bring my coverage of these killings to a close. But this spring, I've been living half-time in Macomb County, just a few miles west of Mount Clemens, and one day, when I had some free time, I decided that I had to have a look at this James Lossing. I needed to literally see for myself if he could be the guy. Sure, the method of kidnapping didn't fit. The murder-suicide didn't fit. And the location, it didn't fit either. But I wanted to know. And yes, the Michigan State Police representative on the task force in 78 said he wasn't the guy. But they were still looking for a blue gremlin. So I wanted to get a look at him and see if he had potential to be a suspect in the case. And when I say that I want to get a look at James Lossing, I mean literally. I want to see what he looks like. My first thought was to contact the Macomb County Sheriff's Office and see if they had a file on the case, and if the file had photos of him. And no, sorry, they don't have any photos of Lossing. So if we go all the way back to episode 1, when I covered the murder of Judy Farrow in Redford, the babysitter who was murdered just after midnight on January 1st, 1976, in 2018, the Redford Township Police didn't have much of a file on her either, just a few pages and no photos at all. So the Macomb County Sheriff not having a picture was not much of a surprise. So then I contacted the Clinton Township Police. I'd like to know what they have on Lossing. I submitted a Freedom of Information Act request, or a FOIA, via email, and about 90 minutes later, I get a call from a very pleasant supervising officer at the department. He would like to know why I'm looking at the Lossing case. And I tell him the truth, that I want to get a look at James Lossing, and that I know this is a sensitive case because the victim was the son of a police officer. But what I'm really looking for is an idea of what James Lossing looked like. And this very nice officer tells me that he can't help me, that they have no file on the case. No file on James Lossing at all. The officer who called me happens to be a longtime veteran of the department, and he was a young officer or maybe even a cadet back in 78 when this happened. But when he saw the name James Lossing, he knew exactly what case I was interested in. But the information that they have no file on the case? That stopped me cold. How can there not be a file on what was likely the most brutal homicide in Clinton Township that year? And then it hit me. I ran into the same issue in the case of Cynthia Cadju. Her case was also discussed in episode 1. She was the high schooler who was kidnapped in Roseville, and then her body was dumped on Franklin Road in Bloomfield. When I contacted Roseville looking for information on her, they didn't have a file either. Because the file is gone. It's been snapped up by the Child Killer Task Force. There are no files available on any cases that are even peripherally related to the Oakland County child killings, because the task force has them under lock and key. Not only are they locked in a file cabinet somewhere, they're not digitized. No one scanned in the thousands of pages related to these murders. I'd like to think that if all of the documents related to these cases were scanned in and were searchable and sortable, it would put us that much closer to resolving these murders. But with the costs associated with digitizing a file of this size, I don't see it happening. So, good luck getting a look at anything on Lossing or on Cadju. Just like the Freedom of Information Act request I submitted in the murder of Birmingham art dealer John McKinney, I wasn't getting it because it's simply not available. And I'm certain I could FOIA the Lossing file from the Michigan State Police, but I'm willing to bet that the cost of that file would be prohibitive. And I'm not accusing anyone of anything. I'm simply sharing with you what my experience has been as I've tried to gather information on these murders and make some sense of the madness that enveloped my community in the second half of the 1970s. So here I am with no access to the police files. I'm back at square one. And I really want to read through the file on the Chisholm case, but it's not going to happen. I can't get a look at the file, so I want to go look at James Lossing himself. I drove to the Mount Clemens Library to pull back issues of the Macomb Daily, and I spent a solid hour squinting at slightly fuzzy microfilm of 40-year-old newspaper stories about the case, and I saw photos of Hildegard Lossing, of Brian Chisholm's funeral. I noted with sadness that the obituaries for the killer and his young victim were published the same day. Thankfully, they were not positioned near each other on the page. But I didn't see photos of the young victim or the perpetrator. What I did learn is that James Lossing was a 1974 graduate of Mount Clemens High School, and here I am, in the local history room at the Mount Clemens Library. So I packed up the microfilm, turned off the machine. I was in search of the cheerful gray-haired woman who had unlocked the local history room for me and offered a quick orientation on their microfilm readers. I found her at the circulation desk and asked if the library had old yearbooks. After surrendering my driver's license as collateral, I was handed the Mount Clemens High School yearbook for 1974. And there he was, James Edward Lossing. Now, the yearbook was almost 2 inches thick and filled with pictures and stories, but there was only one mention and one photo of him, and that was his senior picture. I was hoping that he would be angular and dark-haired. Maybe he'd look a little bit like the sketch that the task force liked to share around. His senior picture is a black-and-white photo, and in it, Lossing is chubby. His hair appears light brown, perhaps reddish. His face is rounded, and his eyes are small. His front teeth are prominent. He has a double chin. Lossing is dressed in a sport coat, pale shirt, and a tie with wide stripes. And I don't know if he had a similar build 4 years later when he kidnapped and murdered Brian Chisholm, but Lossing is distinctive looking and appears nothing like the sketch provided by witnesses the night that Timmy King disappeared. And listeners, I was disappointed. I'd wanted Lossing to look like that sketch, and he didn't. As I dejectedly returned the yearbook and collected my driver's license, the librarian told me I looked sad. Was I okay? Did I find what I was looking for in the microfilm and the yearbook? I told her that yes, I sort of did, but it was too much to explain. And listeners, as someone who writes about the murdered and the missing on a daily basis, I'm not always comfortable talking to strangers about what I do, especially when it involves child murder. It can make for some decidedly awkward interactions. So I told her that I was looking into a murder from 1978, and while I found what I was looking for, it wasn't what I'd hoped to find. And the librarian asked if I was looking at the murder of Brian Chisholm. And my mouth fell open. Because yes, ma'am, that is what I'm looking for. Apparently, not only did this helpful woman live on the same street as the Chisholm family, Brian's sister worked with her at the library for several years. The library staff was willing to talk about the case. Not only how shocking it was, but that there were still plenty of people in Mount Clemens that remembered the tragedy and horror surrounding the child's death. I learned that Brian's family stayed in their home and their neighborhood for several years after Brian was taken from them in such a cruel and brutal way. It was interesting to hear firsthand accounts of what the community went through in 1978 and the years that followed.
While Mount Clemens is a city of about 20,000 people, there is nothing like a horrific tragedy to unite a community. And as I mentioned earlier, the Macomb Daily ran obituaries for Brian and James on the same day. The Chisholm family was Catholic, and Brian had a funeral mass at St. Peter's Catholic Church and would be buried in the church cemetery. James Lossing had a simple visitation and was buried at Mead Cemetery in Macomb, Michigan. James' parents would be buried near him, his father in 1985 and his mother in 2004. James' older brother died in 2016. The Chisholm family remained in Mount Clemens for decades after Brian's murder, eventually settling out of state. It is my sincere hope that the memory of their sweet boy is now and continues to be a blessing. Over the next few weeks, we will complete our coverage of the Oakland County child murders. We will explore what became of the many suspects orbiting this case and discuss what happened to some of the major players, including many of the original investigators. And I will be sharing with you my theory of the killings as well. After 40 years, the tip line for the Oakland County child killer case is active once again. That number is 833-784-9425. If you are having trouble getting through, or if the voicemail box is full, please keep trying. Don't Talk to Strangers is a Spective podcast production. I'm Nina Instead, the writer and voice behind Don't Talk to Strangers. I appreciate you listening, and please, be safe.
I love the band so much, I didn't want to do anything that would threaten that.
He had a room where he could see out, where no one could see in.
Was it my fault? Did I seduce him? Did I make him do this?
Three teachers, five decades, dozens of victims.
I knew there was something wrong with him.
Why was he allowed to continue teaching?
The band played on. Now available for free on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app.
At the heart of every crime, there's a lie.
In order to do this job well, you're going to have to learn to lie. But you're going to have to remember who you're lying to and when to lie and when not to lie.
But a lie is only powerful if you choose to believe it.
It all came out. All the story came out. It turned out he had two wives and five fiancés, that he wasn't marrying women because he loved them. He was actively impregnating women to rip them off for money, me being one of them.
So why do we fall for it every time?
My father told me at a young age, he says, Carl, the two easiest things to sell anybody, anything that'll improve their looks, and anything that'll make them money. And that's what you want to sell.
Pretend Radio is a documentary podcast about people pretending to be someone else. I interview real con artists, snake oil salesmen, and former cult members. Anyone living a lie. Search for Pretend Radio wherever you get your podcasts.